Afghanistan's incumbent President Hamid Karzai has responded to heavy international and U.S. pressure by conceding to a runoff election on November 7th. This summer's presidential election was marred by rampant vote fraud, in which Karzai was most strongly implicated. At a Kabul press conference on Tuesday with Senator John Kerry, Karzai called upon Afghans to show up to the polls a second time this year. Kerry heads up the influential Senate Foreign Relations Committee and has spoken out against increasing U.S. troop numbers in Afghanistan until a government credible to the Afghan people is elected. But Secretary of State Hillary Clinton openly admitted last week that she expected Karzai to win a runoff election. She added that the U.S. may choose to work more closely with regional leaders. The White House is currently reviewing its Afghanistan strategy and debating whether or not to send more troops to a war that has passed the 8-year mark. General Stanley McChrystal, the top U.S. NATO commander in Afghanistan, wants to add 40,000 new U.S. troops to the approximately 100,000 U.S. and NATO forces currently there. Meanwhile, Vice President Joe Biden is advising Obama to preserve troop levels at the current number and narrow the war to counterinsurgency operations along the border with Pakistan. President Obama got some different advice recently at a fundraiser in San Francisco when Code Pink co-founder Jody Evans delivered thousands of signatures of Afghan women asking for no new troops and for a complete exit from the country after a reconciliation process. A CNN opinion research poll released on Monday revealed that 52% of Americans see the Afghanistan war as similar to the Vietnam War. As the White House debates on how best to continue the war, an Afghan women's rights activist who goes by the name Zoya is touring the United States with a message that the occupation must end and that the U.S. is not acting in the interests of ordinary Afghans. Zoya is a member of the Intrepid Underground Women's Organization, RAWA, the Revolutionary Association of the Women of Afghanistan, whom I've been working with for many years. She'll be speaking at several events this week in the Southern California area, Eagle Rock tonight, and Pasadena tomorrow afternoon, and Venice on Thursday. She now joins me in studio for an in-depth interview. Welcome to Uprising, Zoya.
Thank you, Sonali.
Thanks so much for joining us today. So first, let's talk about these elections, which is what the American news media is very much focused on. It's the latest latest stage of U.S. involvement. You were in Afghanistan recently. You saw how this election played out. What was your impression of the election in terms of a democratic exercise, and how would you compare it to the earlier election?
We don't think that it was really a sign of democracy, this election, because RAWA from the very beginning condemned the election as we considered this election a dirty game being played with the destiny of our people. It's a part of the drama of democracy. It's a kind of mockery of democracy, unfortunately. Because from the very beginning, we witnessed that there was so much fraud that even not organizations like RAWA, but also United Nations, European Community, and international observers, and also some international media was speaking. They were forced to speak about how fraudulent the election was. And if I was there, I spoke with any Afghan in Kabul. Even children knew that our president will be elected, will be determined by the foreign Western powers. Our president will be elected by the White House. This is something that every Afghan knows. And this was the reason that why majority of the people did not want to go and to ballot boxes, because a country which is occupied, a country which has no independence, a country which is ruled by terrorism and gun and Kalashnikov and money, how we can expect a fair and free election there. So we think that the fraud in this election was much more than the first election, and there's a reason for that, that unfortunately the Northern Alliance groups, the tribal commanders, the fundamentalist commanders received so much support from the Western countries in the past 8 years, and they are quite powerful than before. So obviously this election has more fraud, and it's more in the shadow of gun and money than the previous one.
But let's talk about Karzai in particular, I mean, he is not somebody who has the same kind of criminal past as the fundamentalist warlords in the parliament do, and that was one reason why the U.S. picked him. But then it seemed as though he became at least verbally critical of the U.S. in terms of the bombings over the last few years that have killed many civilians, and maybe he lost some support from the U.S. Do you think that Karzai has sort of become very isolated and that's why he's just trying to grab onto power?
We can't forget that Karzai was installed by the U.S. Government, and he was just implementing the U.S. policy in the past 8 years. He was a puppet person for United States and other Western powers. He never tried to really eliminate terrorism or care for the for the women of Afghanistan or to establish democracy. Unfortunately, from the very beginning, our people had some hope that compared to, for example, Abdul Abdullah and other famous commanders of fundamentalists who are responsible for the massacre, rape, and destruction of Afghanistan. We can't forget 92 till 94 under the rule of Northern Alliance. So at that time, at the beginning, they thought that Karzai is a new face. At least his hands are not stained with the blood of our people. So maybe he fulfilled his promises. But unfortunately, very soon they realized that he appointed the most famous war criminals in the very key positions. And he always tried to compromise with the Northern Alliance groups. As we know that today also he selected two vice presidents, the two wanted criminal terrorists. So these compromise with the terrorists and working with the Northern Alliance commanders was the main reason behind the that he lost his reputation, and we can say that he betrayed to the vote of our people in the first election. He betrayed democracy in a very painful way.
Mm. So you've brought up the Northern Alliance several times, and if you read the U.S. news, that's not a name that you hear very often. The U.S. news very much covers the growing insurgency of the Taliban, and they'll refer to Abdullah Abdullah and some of the members of parliament as regional commanders or former military commanders, but they don't really talk about who this group is, the Northern Alliance. You mentioned the years 1992 to 1994. Can you explain who exactly Abdullah Abdullah is and who he represents? What is this group, the Northern Alliance, that he represents?
I can say that, unfortunately, this is a very painful fact for Afghani women, Afghani people, and for Rawa. It's quite difficult that we face in the West, a majority of the people, that they are aware about Taliban as a criminal force, as a terrorist force. But unfortunately, they don't know that Northern Alliance were those groups who were first came to power from 92 till 94, and they are responsible, as I said, for the massacre of at least 80,000 civilians were killed only in the capital city of Kabul under their domination. They were the people who hammered nails in the skull of our people. They burned our people in the containers. They raped our four-year-old children, grandmothers and mothers. They were the first who looted Afghanistan. They looted our heritage, our museums. They were the first who destroyed the nation and ruled Afghanistan. So we can't forget these crimes. But unfortunately, the problem is that because the United States government is today working with the Northern Alliance groups, and they are supporting these terrorist parties in order to defeat Taliban. This is the biggest reason that why the media is silent about Northern Alliance, and the Western people think that we have only Taliban terrorists. But unfortunately, we have two kinds of fundamentalist groups, equally dangerous. We consider Northern Alliance more dangerous for our people because they are more clever, they are more hypocrite. Today they are they shave their beards and they are wearing Western clothes, but it doesn't mean that they really believe in democracy and secularism and women's rights.
Now, Abdullah Abdullah is being characterized by the U.S. media as the rival to Karzai. He's been almost characterized as the voice of clarity and reason, pointing out the fraud, the massive fraud by Karzai. But then in one small line in a news article, Karzai officials claim, and I'm quoting here, that Abdullah has asked for 12 ministries as the price of his support. Talk about what exactly does the Northern Alliance leader, the main rival to Karzai, the person who supposedly got the second largest number of votes in this presidential elections, what does he really want, you think?
He represents Northern Alliance fundamentalists, so obviously he wants power. And our people are really in a difficult position because from one side they face Karzai, who already failed in the past 8 years. He compromised with the criminals, with the rapists, with the looters of our country. And everyone knows that he was installed by the foreign powers. He is not an independent person. But at the same time, they are facing another person, which is worse than Karzai, I can say, because he was one of the top commanders belonging to Northern Alliance Group, belonging to Jamiat-e-Islami, the Islamic, fundamentalist party. And even the children of Afghanistan know who is Abdullah. So our people are really in a kind of difficult position. They have to choose between two, three criminals, which is quite, a difficult choice for our people. Mm-hmm. They want more power, definitely. Abdullah want the domination of fundamentalists, Northern Alliance fundamentalists in the power.
Now, his group, the Northern Alliance, dominates the parliament already, right? I mean, they have managed to get many seats in parliament. And is that the reason why over the last 8 years we've seen a loss of women's rights? There was this law that was recently passed earlier this year by the parliament and signed by Karzai, the law that governs the Shia community that some journalists found legalizes the rape of married women. And I understand the parliament also has passed amnesty bills, have passed laws against press freedom. I mean, this is why we're seeing these sort of very repressive laws coming out of the parliament?
Exactly. It's a quite painful reality for our people to see these criminals, these anti-women forces, these fundamentalist commanders, again in the power, and they are the members of parliament. They are legislating for our people. So obviously, what kind of law they may make? Just the laws who benefit themselves. For example, National Conciliation Bill they passed to forgive their past war crimes. Or again, the situation of women, we can't consider as a sign of liberation of women the presence of 67 women in the seats of parliament, because they are not representing the women of Afghanistan. They are in some way have contacts with the Northern Alliance groups, and many they are in compromise with fundamentalist groups. Or the women ministry cannot be a sign of liberation of Afghan women.
So just going back to the Northern Alliance in the parliament, at this point, when Hillary Clinton, our Secretary of State, says that the U.S. might choose to work with regional commanders, how do you interpret that?
I think they should say, instead of regional commanders, that U.S. want to work with war criminals, because they are not really regional commanders. They are war criminals. They are terrorists. That's a better way to say it.
I'm speaking with Zoya. If you've just tuned in, that's an assumed name that she goes by. She's with the organization RAWA, the Revolutionary Association of the Women of Afghanistan, an underground women's rights group in Afghanistan. They've been operating for more than 30 years there. And Zoya is currently on national tour in the United States. She's going to be speaking, by the way, tonight at the Center for the Arts in Eagle Rock, 2225 Colorado Boulevard in L.A. And she'll be speaking alongside acclaimed activist, writer, and analyst Tom Hayden, as well as Afghan war veteran Rick Reyes. And there's going to be a screening of Rethink Afghanistan, an excerpt of that, tonight at the Center for the Arts in Eagle Rock, starting at 7 p.m. And also she's going to be at the Pasadena City College tomorrow afternoon from 1 to 3 p.m. at room C333, 1570 East Colorado Boulevard in Pasadena. That's tomorrow from 1 to 3 p.m. And then she'll also be in Venice tomorrow night, Thursday, October 22nd, from 6:30 to 8:30 p.m. at the Venice United Methodist Church, Peace Hall, 1020 Victoria Avenue in Venice. And she'll be speaking there alongside feminist playwright Eve Ensler, as well as the co-founder of Code Pink, Jody Evans. And by the way, for security purposes, no cameras of any sort will be allowed at any of the events. And if you missed any of that, check our website later today for the detailed information at kpfk.org/uprising. So yeah, we're going to take a short break in just a moment, but let's briefly, before we do that, talk about the women members of Parliament that you just mentioned. 67 members of Parliament, you said, can't be seen as a sign of women's progress. One female member of Parliament, Malalai Joya, who I've interviewed on this program several times and have worked with, who's also going to be on tour in a few weeks. She was elected to the parliament, but then she was kicked out of parliament. So what does that tell people about women's democratic rights in Afghanistan?
This fact is quite enough to show the nature of the parliament, that they couldn't tolerate a democratic voice of Malalai Joya. Because she was the first woman in the parliament who really represented the majority of the poor population, the majority of the women of Afghanistan. She was the real representative who stood and who spoke about the crimes and brutalities of these terrorists who are enjoying the seats of parliament. But they couldn't tolerate that, as they usually cannot tolerate any democratic voice, even in parliament or outside the parliament. Mm.
Well, we're going to take a short break to hear today's subversive historian, and then we'll also have this week's Who Said That contest. When we come back, we'll continue our interview with Zoya, and later in the hour, we'll speak with Oscar Sanchez, the brother of community organizer Alex Sanchez. He'll be talking about his brother's recent arrest. Stay tuned.
Don't forget your history.
This is Gabriel San Roman, your subversive historian. Back in the day on October 21st, 1835, fierce abolitionist William Lloyd Garrison was attacked by a racist mob in an incident that has come to be known by history as the Boston Riot. The advocate for immediate emancipation of slaves was dragged from a meeting of the Female Anti-Slavery Society. Opponents of abolition authored handbills with titles such as Outrage that encouraged people to obstruct such gatherings wherever they took place. When word reached that British abolitionist George Thompson was going to speak on behalf of the cause in Boston, a mob assembled to look for him. They found Garrison instead, who was reviled for his newsletter, The Liberator, which published staunch views against slavery. The abolitionist was then dragged through the streets of the city by rope. Garrison was saved from certain death by the mayor, who put him in prison for the night for his own protection. For Uprising, this is your truth professor saying it's no mystery why they conceal our people's history.
No more lies. And now we come to the special feature of our program.
Who said that? Who said that?
Where is it?
So what do you call yourself, huh? Como se llama?
I can't hear you.
What's your name, dude?
Who the hell are you?
I really don't know.
If it's anybody, it's me.
Who?
Oh.
Before we go to part two of our interview with Zoya, it's time now for this week's edition of Who Said That, a weekly contest in collaboration with the Pacifica Radio Archives. Here's how it goes. We'll play you a short soundbite from the Archives' vault and ask you to tell us who said that. To win the CD we're featuring, just call in and identify the voice. Let's take a listen to this week's mystery speaker.
I say, I never memorized any poetry in my life. I long ago made up my mind that if it didn't stick to me, I wouldn't stick to it.
And if you know who said that, and if you haven't won yet, call us right now at 818-985-5735 with your best guess. That's 818-985-KPFK. And since it's a little hard this week, I'll give you a hint. The famed poet whose voice we just played read his work at John F. Kennedy's inauguration. And now we turn back to Zoya, a member of the Revolutionary Association of the Women of Afghanistan. She's on tour of the United States currently, and she's now joining me to talk about what's happening inside Afghanistan. Zoya, we've been talking about the government inside Afghanistan, the political situation there. Let's talk about the role of the United States in particular. You've said that they have chosen to work with the Northern Alliance, that Hamid Karzai is a puppet of the U.S. But what about the occupation itself? The fact that there are currently almost 100,000 U.S. and NATO troops in Afghanistan, supposedly to defeat the Taliban and or to defeat al-Qaeda. What role has that played over the last 8 years in the lives of ordinary people?
As we know that United States tried to legitimize its war and occupation under the main banners of bringing democracy, Afghan women's liberation, and so-called war on terror. But we see that after 8 years of war and occupation and many civilian death, with billions of dollars and with so much billions of euros and pounds, we see that we don't see any positive change, radical change in the political situation. There's no security for the people, first of all. The women of Afghanistan, which is one of the main justifications to occupy Afghanistan, was the liberation of women. But we see that in majority of the provinces, women are suppressed as more and less like the Taliban time. We should not just focus on the minority of 10% of women in Kabul, the capital city, who are members of parliament or ministers, or the rich women belong to some, you know, the wives and daughters of the businessmen. We have to talk about 95% of the majority of population living in different villages and rural areas and different provinces. And we hear every day the news of, you know, being raped, kidnapped, killed, gang rape occurs daily, but unfortunately few of them are reported by the media. We just, a couple of months ago, we were witnessed that Bashir, a 14-year-old girl, was gang raped by the son of the member of parliament of Afghanistan, and there was no justice for this girl because the father of this son was one of the top fundamentalist warlords and drug lords. So similarly, you can see that the women do not have justice. There is no one who can hear their crying voice. If President of Afghanistan pardoned the criminals and the rapists after three nights, as what Karzai has not really got tired in the past 8 years was pardoning the rapists, protecting the criminals, and honoring them with prizes and medals. This was what he was doing. So in this situation, we see that self-immolation and suicide is increasing day by day among women, and particularly the young generation of Afghanistan. If you go to provinces like Herat, you see that the hospitals are full of the cases, burnt cases, because they are quite hopeless of the situation.
And so women are burning themselves.
The women are burning themselves as one of the easiest way. Instead of gradual death, they prefer to die once. And we see that this occupation and war was not able to bring us democracy, as we see the sign of democracy. If we consider as one of the main signs of democracy, election, we saw the what kind of funny joke was our election. The journalists have very tough and threatening life. Many journalists have been killed, kidnapped, and murdered, because a single word against the warlords will amount to their murder. And also we see that terrorism is getting more powerful. They are increasing day by day. The Taliban are ruling 80% of Afghanistan. So it was a failed war. And we think that we are quite disappointed with the President Obama's suggestion of throwing more troops, and we believe that billions and millions of troops will not help the situation as long as the United States will not radically change its wrong foreign policy in Afghanistan.
So is the occupation in any way protecting women from the Taliban and the Northern Alliance? Because some would say that if the occupation were to end tomorrow, if the president pulled out all troops tomorrow, that women would be at the mercy of the Taliban and the Northern Alliance.
As I said, that 80% of Afghanistan is today ruled by the Taliban. So for the majority, the situation can't be worse because it's already worse. Yes, it will definitely affect, as I said, the owners of the city centers in Kabul, the big hotels and Italian restaurants and Chinese restaurants, and it will definitely affect the workers of NGOs. It will definitely affect the United Nations workers. It will definitely affect members of parliament and ministers, but not majority of the population of Afghanistan, because they are already, from one side, they are under the suicide bombs and, you know, stoning to death and amputation and killing of the Taliban. From the other side, they are being raped and gang raped and kidnapped and killed by the Northern Alliance commanders. And from the other side, they have additional problem of U.S. NATO bombs every day. Mm-hmm. So for them, the situation is already worse. It can't be worse.
So what about the other option of some kind of a reconciliation process, sitting down with all of the players involved, including women and women's rights activists and maybe even groups like Rawa and the people in parliament and even former Taliban or reformed Taliban commanders? I mean, this is something that some Americans have and some American members of government have talked about very prominently. What is, you know, your opinion of a negotiated diplomatic solution?
We think that it's not possible to have a peace process with criminals. It's not possible to do that. It will be failed. As it's proved many times, these criminals went even to Saudi Arabia in Makkah to swear there that after that there will be no fighting and they will have some peace in Afghanistan. But we saw that just after a week of that, again, the civil war started. Again, there was killing and, you know, raping and kidnapping and these things. So we see that it's not possible to have peace process with such terrorists and criminals who are responsible for the pain and miseries of our people. And we are totally against that because it will not bring any radical change, because we think that peace without justice is not possible. And they are responsible for injustice in the country.
So then what should be done to hold these men accountable, to hold the Northern Alliance and the Taliban accountable? Who can hold them accountable? Who should hold them accountable?
We think that occupation and war will not help. The troops will not help. It's something that it's the responsibility of the democratic forces of Afghanistan, the democratic movements, who are, I accept they are weak, but they exist. They are committed to bring any change. And with the help and solidarity of the people around the world, they will be empowered. And by relying on our painful people, we can stand up and resist against them. This is how we can do. And if United States government is really, you know, feel, if they're really kind enough and they really feel sorry for the people of Afghanistan, they should first of all stop supporting these Northern Alliance fundamentalist groups, that they are giving them more power. They should start supporting democratic movements in Afghanistan. They should disarm these the private army of fundamentalist groups. They should disempower these war criminals from the key governments. I mean, they have other options in front of them if they really want to bring any radical change.
What about the Taliban? Should the U.S. government, and in fact, just in terms of where the Taliban is getting its support, would you say that the government of Pakistan needs to be involved?
Exactly. Pakistani government, I mean, in the past history, if we see that Pakistani government created Taliban, unfortunately, under the time of the Benazir Bhutto, a women prime minister, they sent to Afghanistan. And today also, behind the scenes, Pakistani government is helping Taliban. But we think that it's quite, you know, painful that United States government, U.S. and NATO troops are throwing a bomb on our innocent civilians. They are killing our children and women and attacking wedding parties of people. But from the other side, the leader of the Taliban is enjoying key position in the parliament of Afghanistan. He was a top wanted terrorist, was allowed to run election campaign and candidate himself for the presidential election. So we see that there is a hypocrisy of the governments. There is a kind of contradictory policies in the country.
Mm. You mentioned the civilian victims of the U.S. bombing. Tell us about some of the internally displaced refugees from the U.S. bombs, particularly from the Helmand region, where the U.S. recently inserted 4,000 extra troops this year. There's been a sort of impromptu camp set up outside Kabul, housing many, I think, thousands of these refugees.
Exactly. I mean, only our poor, innocent people is already paying the price for the so-called war on terror, not the Taliban and other people. So they were displaced. They have to come in Kabul, and we see just few kilometers far from the presidential palace in the refugee camps. The people are dying. They are starving to death. And it's a big shame for a country who's receiving billions of dollars that the people are dying from very primary sicknesses and because of hunger. Even some families had to sell their children because they can't feed them. So, and also, I mean, from one side, the bombs, and from the other side, this displacement. It really, you know, only the people of Afghanistan are paying the price for the so-called war on terrorism, which I consider it's more like a drama than a real, honest war against terrorism.
My guest is Zoya. She's a member of RAWA, the Revolutionary Association of the Women of Afghanistan, currently touring the United States. She's just returned, in fact, from the East Coast, where she gave a number of addresses in New York, Washington, D.C., and Boston. She's going to be speaking tonight at the Center for the Arts in Eagle Rock at 2225 Colorado Boulevard in L.A. from 7 to 9 p.m. She'll be speaking alongside Tom Hayden and Rick Reyes, Afghan war vet, and there'll be a screening of an excerpt of Rethink Afghanistan from 7 to 9 p.m. again tonight. Tomorrow she'll be at the Pasadena City College from 1 to 3 p.m. in the afternoon at room C333, and that's at 1570 East Colorado Boulevard in Pasadena. And then tomorrow night, her final event will be at the Venice United Methodist Church in Venice, Peace Hall, and that's 1020 Victoria Avenue. That event is from 6:30 to 8:30 p.m., presented by Code Pink. Code Pink co-founder Jody Evans will be speaking, as well as acclaimed feminist playwright Eve Ensler, who has long supported RAWA. And for security purposes, no cameras, still, or video will be allowed at this event. So, Zoya, let's talk about the reason why you are essentially an underground activist, and RAWA is an underground women's movement. RAWA members have to use false names, cannot be photographed. Tell us about this organization that's the oldest women's political group in the country, and what RAWA's main agenda is.
When RAWA was established in 1977, the main aim of RAW was to struggle for the women's rights, for the equality of men and women. But very soon, the resistance war against Soviets started, and RAW took part in that in some way. And then in 1992, when Islamic fundamentalists took the power, RAWA's focus was struggling against fundamentalism. Until today, we believe in the independence of Afghanistan. We are against the occupation of Afghanistan under any name. And we are struggling, we are exposing fundamentalist groups, both Northern Alliance and Taliban, and we are trying to defend democracy, secularism, and women's rights and freedom in the country.
So how dangerous is it for RAWA to operate openly? Why does RAWA operate underground, I should say?
Obviously, we are facing such bloody enemies that they only know the language of gun and Kalashnikov. They don't believe in democracy. And as RAWA was one of the radical organization, always exposing them. So definitely, they try to use any opportunity to silence RAWA as they killed our leader. They always attacked our demonstrations. But at the same time, they use different means against RAWA, like by killing or by giving us different accusations. But they tried to silence RAWA, which is which I consider is the voice of the voiceless people of Afghanistan.
You mentioned they killed your leader, Mina, the founder of RAWA. Tell us a little bit about Mina and why she was killed, you think.
She was the founder of RAWA, and with some other intellectual women, she founded RAWA in 1977. She was at that time a student in the Kabul University, and her aim and objective was to struggle for women's rights, and she was one of the outspoken voices against fundamentalism. So obviously, as I said, they can't tolerate any radical voice, particularly from a woman. So she was killed by Islamic Party with the help of KGB agents.
So both the Soviet occupiers and the fundamentalists inside Afghanistan saw her as an enemy.
Yes.
Again, I'm speaking with Zoya, who's a member of RAWA. And in the interest of full disclosure, I work very closely with RAWA. I've been working for nearly 10 years with this organization, doing solidarity work with them, supporting their work as a volunteer. And I'm just, you know, so pleased, Zoya, that you're here in the United States right now to help educate Americans about what's going on there, because there's a lot of confusion. On staying on the issue of RAWA itself, just from my 10 years of working with your organization, I have to say there are a lot of different rumors about RAWA that constantly get spread, and some of them can be amusing, but some of them can be quite dangerous. And I want to read off a few, or just rattle off a few of the accusations that I've come across about RAWA. One is that RAWA has received CIA funding. Two is that RAWA is working very closely with the Karzai government. Three, I've heard that RAWA is a Maoist communist organization. And then I've also heard, which of course in the Afghan context is not a compliment because of the communist takeover of Afghanistan. And then I've also heard that or been told that RAWA is pro-Taliban and anti-Northern Alliance, and then on the flip side, pro-Northern Alliance and anti-Taliban. And then, of course, there's the usual accusation of RAWA is a front group for a group of men who are actually running the organization, or American or Western activists who are really running the organization. I've also heard that RAWA members are infidels and prostitutes. Mm-hmm. Where is all of this coming from, you think? And I mean, you must get this sort of thing all the time as well.
Exactly.
How do you defend against these?
I think it all the accusation in some way, I'm glad, because this shows that how RAWA is a serious organization. And RAWA's voice, RAWA's pen, RAWA's firm struggle really affected to the enemies. It's really effective in some way. I think that all the accusations comes from, if RAWA was not a serious organization, definitely they would not bother themselves to think about these lie, you know, and these accusations. But unfortunately, because RAWA's words are really strong against the enemies, so they have, as I said, they have two ways, either to kill us or to influence the public with such very dirty accusations. And how it's possible, it's quite funny. I think there's no need to think about that, that at the same time we are CIA, at the same time we are KGB, at the same time we are the spy for China, at the same time we are Maoist. So it's quite funny. Yes, sometimes when we had demonstration once in Pakistan, in the newspaper of the Taliban, it came that they are prostitutes because they come in the streets to touch the men, their shoulders to touch to the shoulders of men. So such kind of, I can say that these accusations is just the proof of our firm stand in struggle.
Well, Zoya, I want to thank you very much for joining us today on the show. I hope listeners can make it to tonight's event or to tomorrow night's event. You can find out more. We'll list all of the events that she's going to be speaking at our website, kpfk.org/uprising, later today. And RAWA's website, by the way, is rawa.org, rawa.org. Zoya is a member of the Revolutionary Association of the Women of Afghanistan.